This is Appalachian Vibes from WNCW. I'm your host, Amanda Bakke. Appalachian Vibes is a show dedicated to challenging the expectations and celebrating the diversity of music created in and around Appalachia. Today, my guest is Cody Christian, a Powhatan, Virginia-born Americana country artist who made waves in late 2021 when he quit his 8-year job at a shipyard by sending a mass email to every employee that stated, "I deserve to work in an environment where my beard is valued. I've accepted a position as a honky-tonk man, and I can't seem to stop." Adding, "I wish you all the best of luck as you mismanage this company into inevitable bankruptcy." I catch up with Cody Christian about his latest album, Canary in a Coal Mine. That's Appalachian Vibes. Last week on Appalachian Vibes, my guest was Jonah Cardin, an Americana rock and metal-inspired singer-songwriter from southern West Virginia.
Okay, so tell me about My Columbine.
So you had Matt Mullins on last week, right?
I did, yeah.
So I don't know if he talked to you about this or not, but he started this Facebook group, I guess it was in 2020, and it's like a songwriting group. And
I just joined it.
Oh, okay, cool. Did he talk about it on the show at all?
Mm-mm, I didn't even know until he sent me a message.
Oh, okay. So the whole deal is you got a theme or a topic or whatever you want to call it, and you have 2 weeks to write a song about it. And if you don't write your song and get it submitted by the deadline, you get kicked out. So this last round, I think there was 19 of us, and we made it through the whole year. And one of our topics was spring, like the season spring, you know. So I was like, okay, that's cool. So I'm going to write a song about a flower that could also be like a woman's name. So I sat and came up with this song and recorded it and had all the parts. And I was like, all right, I'm going to call it Marigold, you know. That could be like kind of a woman's name, Mary, whatever. Had the whole song written out. Everything was cool. And I was like trying to write the last line of the song. And I was like, well, I probably better, you know, kind of describe what a marigold smells like. So I go to Google because I don't know anything about flowers, you know. So I go to Google and I'm like, what do marigolds smell like? And it's like, marigolds smell awful and are often planted to repel insects from gardens, and people were repulsed by their smell and all stuff. And I was like, so that completely like trashes the whole song. Cause you know, like the chorus was like, how I've missed the scent of your perfume or
oh,
whatever.
No.
So it just completely ruined the whole song. So I had to find another flower that was a spring flower too, by the way. And it had to be three syllables. So the only one I could find that worked was Columbine.
Spring.
was My Columbine by Jonah Cardin. You can learn more about Jonah on social media platforms or check out his music on all streaming platforms. And you can listen to our full interview at AppalachianVibes.net.
My name is Cody Christian. Play some, I guess, country. Some people might call it Americana, but got some, I guess, bluegrassy kind of influence to it. I guess classic feel. You know, most of the stuff was done live on the recording.
So you've had an interesting transition with your career, like over the last 2 years. Do you want to talk about kind of how you've transitioned from full-time work into full-time playing?
Definitely. I mean, I've been playing with a band around Hampton Roads, Virginia for probably 6 years. And then COVID hit, and that made it real hard for us to get together and meet and actually do anything. Just because people, you know, different lives, different situations. But I was still in a position to where, you know, I could get out and play music when my whole band couldn't. So that's really when I started to do, you know, the more country stuff kind of solo. And it just started to get easier and easier to get good shows. And, you know, it was easy to market it too, just being a brand that, or in a genre that I understood more and it came more natural to me. You know, and so I did that probably 2 years. And I was working at a shipyard in Newport News. And I'd been working there for 8.5 years and the music was starting to do pretty good. I was starting to make decent money doing it, and, you know, selling shirts and all that good stuff. And, you know, with the job, I'd been there long enough. And then it got to a point where, you know, they were going to fire me if I didn't shave my beard because their own, you know, they just had a lot of stuff going on. And, that was one of their stipulations, I guess. So instead of shaving or being fired, I just quit and decided, you know, if I were ever going to, you know, take the music stuff seriously and actually do it, you know, I always knew that at some point you'd have to do it, you know, you'd have to take a leap. So I figured, you know, that was the best time. You know, I had good momentum and also didn't want to shave at all. So
I love that it came down to the beard for you.
Yeah, to me that was, I mean, that made it easy to establish a good date, you know, like an actual hard date, like, all right, this is when I'm going to do it.
How long was your beard allowed to be? So for listeners, how long is your beard?
I don't know. It's a few inches. I mean, it's sizable, I guess. But it was I mean, you weren't allowed to have anything. So you had to shave so that you could wear like a respirator. And the job that I had, like, I didn't have to wear a respirator, but it was more of, they were trying to get the whole company ready for a backup plan in case certain people, you know, went on strike. So like I was in a position where, you know, I was never actually going to have to wear the respirator thing. They were just going through the motions of technicalities and stuff. And, I was just really tired of that place anyways. You know, and then they started getting into the personal life of, you know, hey, you got to shave your face. And it's like, yeah, I got too much going on outside of here to do something that I don't want to do to that extent. You know,
you're like, my body, my choice.
Yeah, right. Basically, you know, and I mean, I don't want to get into the, you know, they were getting heavy into that too. Like they were going to fire people for not being vaccinated and stuff. So, I mean, it was, and they were denying like vacation time for people. So to me, it was just like, man, this is getting way too close to my personal life. And I've just got too much going on that I want to do outside of here to let them dictate how I'm going to look or what I'm going to do with my time. So the timing was just right, you know?
So you took this leap of faith. Did you have things, were you making enough money from music that you could just launch straight into that and you were going to be fine?
I mean, it was comparable. I knew that, you know, because I was working Monday through Friday, you know, and I was playing weekends, playing the nights, but I mean, that's, you know, that's it takes it out of you. I was tired, you know, and I was making good money doing that. But I knew that, you know, if I didn't have that 9 to 5 Monday through Friday situation, I could play even more. So, you know, the money wise, yeah, it'd be pretty comparable. It'd just be, you know, I'm more busy now than I've ever been, for sure. Cause it's not, you know, you don't go to work and get the same check every couple of weeks. Like, you got to make sure that you're securing that money. You know, it might be 6 months in advance. So it's a lot more work of going and like getting it, you know, and securing those gigs and stuff. But it's also more rewarding than I think anything that I've done, for sure.
Fat Cat Yankees came down with cash in hand, paid in postscript while sucking dry the land. Black hung ain't an if, but it's a when. Hard to make it out when Papa meets his early end. And the cold king scheme underneath that golden dome. Oh, Charleston, won't you let my people go? We're the saints of Appalachia. Ward off whiskey, yeah, stoned and broke. We got Big Brother's boot against the throws. High on codeine, mining coal. We never ask for help, not from anybody else. Babies come out pining for the pills. Oxycodone flavored mother's milk. Addictions are they passed down in their wills. Yeah, you start out low when you're born up in the hills. And the kingpin sling underneath that golden dome. Oh, Charleston, won't you let my people go? With the saints of Appalachia. Ward off whiskey, yeah, stoned and broke. We got Big Farmer's boot against the thrones. High on codeine, mining coal. We never ask for help, not from anybody else. Greed would take some man that was wild and free. Binds him by his hands, brings him to his knees. Buys the upper hand with his blood money. Made off the backs of them poor and enslaved. But the slaves will have their say. And the slaves will have their day. Ward off whiskey, yeah, stoned and broke. We got Big Farmer's boot against the throws. High on codeine, mining coal. We never ask for help, not from anybody else.
What's changed for you since you were playing those weekend gigs? What's your life like now as a performer?
Recently, sold my house. So I lived in Hampton Roads, and now I'm making a move, closer to Richmond, Virginia. Just trying to be more central there. Cause the goal is to, you know, to play enough in an area to a point where you've got enough of a following to eventually sell tickets. And instead of playing like a 3-hour gig, at a bar, you know, where you're playing a lot of covers. Like the ultimate goal is to, you know, get my band and play like an hour, hour and a half set, you know, sell tickets and sell shirts and stuff. And the main thing is that that's been, I guess, progressing a lot more since I quit, because, you know, I can devote a lot more time to it. But I mean, with that, you know, a lot's changed as far as just treating it like a business, which, I mean, at the end of the day, that is what it is. So, you know, just trying to learn as I go how to run a business, never taking a business class or anything like that. It's been interesting.
Because it's not all talent. Like, you can be the most talented person and have no idea how to launch yourself. And there's tons of music majors across the country who are in that position. And so you're just sorting your way through it as you go. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely could have been a lot more prepared, you know, had a lot more things lined up, but unfortunately for me, that's kind of always the way that I've handled things, you know, knowing what I have to do, but like not really doing it until I put myself in a corner and like force myself to do things. So, you know, that way I'm kind of, learning as I go, which, you know, not the best way of doing things, but
I think that's human nature though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are some people that are a lot more, you know, detail oriented than I am. But I'm forcing myself to be that way, which might not be as comfortable, but I guess it's just the way I do stuff, I guess.
Stick around for more from Cody Christian. Coming up, we discuss an old school recording scam in the music industry. That's next on Appalachian Vibes from WNCW. Yep. What's that song about?
Well, I, you know, it's got three verses, and choruses, I guess. And, you know, it's more of like a story kind of song, but you know, the term canary in a coal mine, I heard that thrown around a lot. And I was like, man, what does that actually mean? You know, and so I look into it and, you know, you learn that like in Appalachia, like the coal mining towns, like what they used to do to make sure that, you know, when people went in there, they wouldn't die because of all the gases and stuff. They would send canaries in there. And if the bird died, you know, they'd know, okay, this is not safe for humans. So, I mean, you know, they'd use a bird, basically to do the dirty work for them so that they could go in and make money and stuff. And, you know, I thought of like, okay, you know, you can compare that to people. I mean, it might not be as dramatic, but, you know, in the song I reference, like, you know, an actual laborer that, you know, is doing the hard work for people and dies, you know, like that's the first verse of the song. You know, so you got the guy making the least amount of money doing the most dangerous stuff. And, you know, if it doesn't work out for them, the company, you know, they're going to move on just like they always did. So it's kind of like the canary in a coal mine thing, like just being sacrificed for somebody else to make more money than you do. You know, and then I go into like the second verse of like myself, you know, working at the shipyard. You know, I'm not saying it's the most dangerous thing in the world, but it's definitely not safe. You know, and I looked at
what was your job at the shipyard?
I was a ship fitter for the first 5.5 years there. So basically, I mean, we were building, aircraft carriers. So it was a lot of welding, burning, and cutting steel and stuff. So, I mean, it had those dangers going with it. And then the last couple of years, I was like in a planning position, which is just a super boring office job, you know, and that's kind of when I realized like, man, I'm making more money in this like planning job than I was when I was actually doing the important stuff of, you know, building this thing. And I mean, that's a huge company that I worked for, you know, and you got people all the way at the top, you know, and I'm not saying that they're not deserving of what they get. It just always felt really backwards, you know, that the people that were, you know, actually putting themselves in danger and, you know, if something happens that, you know, they got the next person in line. And at that place, it was really transparent to me that, you know, I wasn't Cody Christian. I was, you know, whatever number they assigned me. So, you know, it's just, you were a laborer, made to do the dirty work, and, you know, you were getting pennies on the dollar. So, I mean, that was like the second verse of the song. And then the third verse, to me was kind of my experience in the couple Nashville interactions that I've had, where they might find somebody that might have a good song or two, and, you know, they want you to front the money for an album. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, then man, that sucks. You just lost $80,000 on an album or something. And, but if it does work out, you know, you're getting maybe just a small percentage of what you did. I mean, you did all the work, but you're getting pennies on the dollar. So
let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah. It's kind of a long backstory, but I mean, to make it more short, like I got connected with a guy that, like, his job title is a dot connector. Like, if you looked at his LinkedIn, like that's what he's called. And he used to manage, a band that did a pretty good run in Nashville. Like, he was their manager back in the day. You know, they had a hit song that did pretty well. But he got me hooked up with a producer in Nashville that, you know, had been around town forever. You know, he's got a lot of credits to his name. So, I mean, he's a credible guy, you know, and they set it up and they're like, hey, you know, this, they want you to come to Nashville, you know, and let's talk, you know, and see what we can do, because, like, we think your songs that we've heard are really great and that they could, you know, really do something. And so, you know, I go to Nashville, and I meet with this producer. And I mean, the first thing they do, they take me to, like, Ocean Wave Studios, which, I mean, is one of the premier Nashville studios. They're like, you know, this is where all the greats have recorded, you know. And dude, for this album, like, man, I mean, they showed me, like, the rooms that we would be going in, and, like, this is where we would record. And, like, dude, we could get Johnny Cash's old pedal steel player on this thing, and we could get Jason Aldean's drummer on this, like, top-notch stuff. You know, we're going to get Lady Antebellum's old producer to, like, co-produce this stuff. And I was like, man, like, that's really big. Like, yeah, man, this thing could be international. I was like, okay, cool. Like, so, I mean, how does this work? And they're like, well, I mean, all in all, you know, you're going to want to get video footage of this. You're going to want to promote it right and all that stuff. So it's going to cost probably, if you want to do, like, a 10 song album, like $80,000. I was like, okay, that's cool. Who's paying for it? And they're like, well, you are. I was like, oh, okay. So is that $80,000? Is that just for the album, or is that 80 grand and like the legs, you know, to actually get this thing going, like the publishing, the PR and all that stuff? And they're like, well, no, but if you do it with us, like, it makes it easier. So you can take this $80,000 album and you can go to this publisher, you know, and be like, hey, I recorded this here with these people. And I was like, okay, that doesn't sound like a good debt. Like, so, I mean, why wouldn't I take a $5,000 album that I can make with really good people where I live and just take it to those same people, since you're not going to give me the legs for it? But on top of that, yeah, they wanted, you know, 50% of those production credits or whatever. Like, you know, they wanted to own you. Like, they were talking 360 deals and stuff like that. And it's like, man, it sounds to me like, you know, I mean, yeah, if things really worked out for me, then yeah, that'd be awesome. But if things don't work out, like, I'm the only person that walks away from this really screwed, you know? So to me, it was really transparent that, you know, yeah, I mean, it's an easy deal if it works out for them, because they've, you know, they've invested a little bit of time, but not really, because they made a lot of money off of me. And worst case scenario, like, they made a lot of money to record this album, and maybe they don't get much money on the back end because it flops. But to me, it's like, man, I just want to work with people that believe in me. And that doesn't sound like somebody that believes in me. That sounds like somebody that's like, yeah, I'm going to take this money and maybe I'll make more, maybe not. But at the end of the day, if anybody's going to lose, it's only going to be me, you know? And if anybody's going to win, like, they're probably winning more than I do. And I mean, at the end of the day, like it's a business, you know, and I'm making music, like music's art, but if you're also trying to make a living off of it, it is a product. So like if I'm the product, like it, I mean, shouldn't I have some say in what's going on? Like it was a really crappy deal, you know?
So you dodged it. You were, what did you say to them?
I told them exactly that. It's like, I need, you know, if you want me to do this, like I want to work with people that believe in me, that are willing to invest in something. Cause if you're not willing to invest in this, like anybody, you can find anybody on the street that would say like, yeah, you know, I'll invest nothing into this and maybe win. You know, it's like getting a free scratch ticket. You know, if you don't pay for it, like, yeah, all you can do is win. I know that there's people out there that are willing to, you know, if they really believe in the product, like they'll invest. I just haven't found them yet. You know, I've talked to Nashville people and, you know, like managers that maybe they want 20%, which is high by my understanding for management. You know, and they want, it's like 20% of every dollar that you ever make. So every shirt that you sell, every show that you play, every stream that you get, like your manager's getting 20%. And to me, like if you're a really good manager and you can take, you know, my product that right now I'm getting 100% of whatever I can do organically by myself. Like if you can amplify that dramatically, then yeah, I mean, sure, you're worth that 20%. But like if the way that they've been presenting it to me is, hey man, you could take this album and we'll take it to this PR person, you know, and I'll set up this phone call and this meeting, and like they're gonna want $3,000 to make all this stuff happen. I was like, okay, if you want 20% of that, you know, whatever 20% of $3,000 is, I feel like that's what you should invest if you really believe in this product. And unfortunately, I haven't found anybody that's, you know, said, yeah, you know, that I believe in you that much. And to me, if somebody doesn't believe in me that much, then why would I work with them? You know, so I can take my time, you know, and I know like Luke Combs, his manager, I think his name is like Chappie or something. My understanding, like listening to podcasts and stuff like that with them, is, you know, their deal was, you know, hey, Luke Combs, like, I'm not going to take a cent until you make this much money. Like, however much money you feel like you need to make until, you know, you believe in this, that this is working. Like, I believe in you this much that, you know, I'm not even going to ask for money until we get to this point. Like, I would love to work with somebody that genuinely believes in it, you know, but unfortunately to do that, like you got to put your money where your mouth is, you know? And that's,
well, think about this. Instead of thinking about money, think about resources, you know, like somebody with the resources. So like often I find that it's not the money that I need, but what I'm after that I need.
And I mean, and the people that were a part of this album, I mean, those are all people that, I mean, I really like and respect. And I mean, and they do believe in it, because, you know, instead of them, you know, saying like, hey man, you know, give me $1,000. I'll play on this album. They're like, dude, I believe that this is going to be great. Like if I could just get like a small percentage of writing credits on this thing, or like, or just put my name on it. Like, you know, I'd love to be a part of it. Like, those are the kinds of people that I want to work with, you know?
So Canary in a Coal Mine. So you have this experience with the Nashville people. You're like, I love your response to them. And I wonder, how did they respond when you said that?
They didn't. Trail went cold. You know, and and my understanding, like I've got friends that live in Nashville, you know, and I've talked to them about that, and they're like, yeah, man, that was like an old school scam. Like those are old school people that, you know, that's like the old model of doing things. Like, I don't want to put down, you know, all of Nashville, because I know that there's good stuff there. There's good people. But there's also still old business tactics that just, I don't know, man. And the sad thing is, like, there probably are still people that would go and do that. And, you know, maybe it would work out for them, but I just know that that's not the way that you have to do things anymore, even though that's what people still try to sell you, you know.
Heard his wife cry from the window. She lost her loving man. Yes, a man falls in black lung. Turn my good buddy dead. And the union wasn't paying. Said there wasn't no evidence that my neighbor died from labor at the company expense. He's a canary in a coal mine. Man takes that old cold king to cut a free bird's wings. He'll never sing again. Making pennies on a dollar, put away to meet an end. I make a living for the family. I got babies on the way. When the shipyard whistles blowing, it means daddy's getting paid. I ain't never been happy building those war machines, but those checks, they keep a coming, courtesy of the Middle East. I'm a canary in a coal mine that might never fly again. Plucked out of the blue sky to make richer men. Takes that old war king to cut a free bird's wings. I might never sing again. Making pennies on a dollar.
Stick around for Cody Christian's shocking resignation letter that launched him into a hero and legend among the Newport shipyard he worked at for 8 years. That's next on Appalachian Vibes from WNCW. This is Appalachian Vibes from WNCW. I'm your host, Amanda Bakke. If you're just joining me, my guest is Cody Christian, an Americana country Virginia singer-songwriter with strong convictions and strong songwriting skills.
I'm more comfortable singing in front of like 100 people that I don't know than like 3 people that I do, or like a cappella kind of stuff. Get all like seized up and it's a weird thing. I don't know what's wrong with me.
I definitely would rather sing in front of 100,000 people rather than 3. I just feel more judgment. I feel like though, if they're just like, I don't know. I feel like my parents would be the worst, you know?
Exactly. And like my mom, like she hates it, but Yeah, I mean, I've told her too. I was like, "This, look, Mom, I wouldn't get nervous in front of a room full, like you said, 1,000 people. But like, if you were in there, or like my family, or if it were like a more intimate thing, like I'd be sweating, like worrying, like holding back, like I don't know.
I hold back in my backyard by myself just because I'm afraid like neighbors will hear me in their house.
Oh yeah. Yeah, like I mean, growing up when I was playing music, like I'd wait until nobody was home before I'd sing, you know. And like same thing when I got older and had roommates, like I'd wait until they were gone, really like belt it out and try to do some stuff.
How long did it take you to get the nerve? Was it easy just to get in front of a bunch of people the first time? Or you grew up playing in church, so you're thrust in a different position.
Yeah, I mean, I played guitar before I sang for probably 4 years. And the first time that I ever sang in front of people, I was actually singing in Spanish, and I sang in Peru. Like, we were on a missions trip, and that was the first time that I ever sang in front of people. And I mean, terrified. Like, thinking back on it, it might be the most scared, nervous, shaken I've ever been. I was probably felt that for, I mean, a while, probably a year or two. And I mean, I don't really get too nervous anymore, you know, getting in front of people. It's not very often. Really the only time is like, if I'm doing like a headlining thing that's ticketed. And even then, I'm just more nervous about people actually being there.
I didn't see it coming, but Lord, it overtook me fast. Some ghost got inside of my head and stole the good thoughts I had. And you didn't have to love me through it all, but I love that you did. You were my first crush, my first touch, my first love. You were the one. And I know I ain't an easy man to love. There's a dark cloud over my heart, won't let in the light. Through the wind and the rain and the thunder, you stay by my side. And you didn't have to hold me through it all, but I'm glad that you did. You're the fire when the dark that's in my mind stays too long. And I know I ain't an easy man to love. Yeah.
Tell me about your song 2 Week Notice.
So, I mean, I wrote that song before I quit my job, actually. You know, it was just me kind of like, I think, foreshadowing maybe what I knew I was going to do anyways. I knew I wasn't going to work there forever. I knew I wanted to do some music. So that's where like the first verse of that song came from. And then the second verse, you know, it was me just kind of imagining things like, okay, maybe this works out. Like I start getting on the road, playing music a lot more, and maybe I'm in a relationship with somebody and, it's not going good, you know, and maybe they don't like me for who I am, you know, and what I'm doing. It's not working out. So no, relationship goes bad. You give that a 2 week notice, just like I gave my job.
And you actually became a legend and myth at the shipyard you used to work for. Tell me about how you resigned.
I mean, the way it worked there, I mean, I'd worked there for a long time, and it came down to, I was playing music a lot. You know, I knew that I wanted to make that transition to, you know, at least try this thing, you know, and the only way to really try it is to really, you know, take a leap and do it. And it just happened to be at the same time that the shipyard was really pissing me off, just getting way too involved in my personal life. Like, they were going to fire me if I didn't shave. You know, and I really didn't like that job enough to, shave my face for them for what I saw as being a really, really, really dumb reason. And they didn't even have to do that to me. That was the worst part. Like, they didn't have to push that hard, but I mean, they gave me several warnings. And on the last one, they're like, "Hey man, if you don't show up to this class clean shaven, like, you will be fired that day." And so that day I was supposed to come in clean shaven. And instead of doing that, I came in with my beard. I was wearing like my denim. I had my, you know, my nice cowboy hat on and stuff. And I sent out a email, which with my resignation letter, to about, I think, 3,000 to 5,000 people the email was sent to. And then that, you know, quickly went around. I think there's like 30,000 people that work there. So, I mean, the letter was pretty all audacious.
What'd you say in your letter?
So basically, I mean, I addressed it to whom it may concern. You know, I'm informing you of my intentions to, quit this job effective right now. You know, I want to work at a company where my beard is valued. And I also put in that letter, you know, promote my album. Like, hey, I've got an album dropping, 2022, Canary in a Coal Mine. You can find it on all streaming platforms. Let me see. But I was gigging with my guitar. My friends told me I might get far. So I came up with a plan and I bought a van. But the road dog life can't happen when you're working 9 to 5. So here's my 2 week notice, then I'm bidding you goodbye.
Two.
That was 2 week notice from Cody Christian. You can learn more about Cody Christian at CodyChristianMusic.com. Up next, it's Robin Landsong, a medicine singer's story of how she escaped a kidnapping and imminent death. That's next on Appalachian Vibes from WNCW. You're listening to Appalachian Vibes from WNCW. I'm your host, Amanda Bakke. My next guest is Robin Landsong, a medicine singer with a harrowing story of how she came to embody this gift. In 1977, Robin was 8 years old when she was abducted walking home from school in a Virginia suburb. She was quickly trafficked to Africa during the height of the Rhodesian War, where she experienced brutality and violence, resulting in 2 near-death experiences. She was called back to life by the medicine song of a rural Zimbabwean woman. It opened Robin's own medicine song, and as an adult, she has given medicine singing to over 14,000 people.
My story begins in 1977, when I was 8 years old, post-Vietnam War. And what happened is I was actually exposed to a lot of unsafe adults. And one of those adults chose to abduct me. And I was a kid who walked home from school by myself. So it was that time period where kids weren't watched as much in 1977. And so he came and got me after school. And it was the end of the school year, and he drugged me and took me to the Philadelphia International Airport and actually took me out of the country. So when I became conscious again, the drugs had worn off. I was in a military base, and it took me time to figure that out. And so I was with this man who was incredibly confused, incredibly violent, incredibly aggressive. And so as a kid, I had to learn how to survive that moment, his particular mental health state. And it sounds like a strange thing to say, but it's kind of fortunate that I was already had survived abuse, so I knew how to be silent. I knew how to cope. I knew how to strategize. And I also had a really highly developed intuition to try and read adults and figure out my best strategy. So my life was in danger with him at all times. And the way that we ended up initially getting separated was he assaulted me. People came and took him away from me and put me in a hospital. And he had broken my ribs. So what happened next is that he actually came and got me from the hospital, and nobody stopped him. And he took me with him, that we were in Africa. And I now understand it was Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. The best I can put together, he was going to be a mercenary and fight for the white government. He needed to get rid of me because he was going into the field. And so he gave me to another man. That man kind of took me in on a bus. He was a black African man. And we got on one of the rural buses, which ended up breaking down. The bus couldn't be fixed. We all had to get off. What happened is I couldn't keep up. You know, I was defeated. I was hungry. My painkillers were wearing off. I had just gotten out of the hospital and I wasn't actually ready to be out of it. And so the man left me behind, and maybe that's what his job was just to lose me somewhere. 1977, it was the height of the Rhodesian War. And my chances of surviving out there by myself without a shelter, without supervision, was really, really low. And so what happened was a truck full of soldiers came along, and I thought, okay, this is going to be the end to my 8 miserable years. And it's going to be quick, and it's going to be over, and I'm going to get to go home to my source. And they picked me up. To my surprise, they picked me up and put me on the truck. And I thought, well, they're going to just take me somewhere else, and that's going to be the end of my life. We went back to an area, and they unloaded me. And one of the other soldiers who was still there was looking at me like he wanted to end my life. He wanted just to shoot me. He was an incredible amount of hatred. And so one of the men who had helped me get off the truck, they argued over me. And so the man who wanted to save my life, he won. And so I lived. And he took me out of there. He took me to where I think he thought would be sympathetic to a white child. And what's called a homestead, we would call a village. And I spent the night in a tree by myself because I was too afraid to go into the village at night. And in the morning, I heard singing. And so it was the singing that drew me in. And I crept closer and closer. And I saw these women. And they were grinding corn. And they were singing like there was joy in their work. Like there was community in terms of even just how they were doing this basic daily act of grinding the corn. And I had never seen people sing while they worked. I had never seen people so alive in what they were doing. And I almost forgot my hiding, and I kind of crept out from behind a tree. And when they saw me, they were so surprised. Keep in mind, this is 1977. There really aren't other white people around. So to see a white child, they were very startled. I crept out and my mouth was totally dry. I was hungry, and they went and they got some food and some water and they set it out for me. And at first I ran away and I came back and I drank up the food and I ate up the boiled cornmeal, which is called mealy meal. And I stayed watching them, and they just let me be near them. And again, just this singing, this rhythmic aliveness. And I kind of would creep closer, but then they would move and I would run back farther away. And so two other people came over, an older man, and he was trying to check me out. And so I stayed my distance. What they did at night was they set out someplace for me to sleep. They had invited me in, but I was too scared to go into a hut with them. And so they laid out a goat skin, and I slept on the goat skin. And in the morning, it was the children who gathered around me, and they were touching my white skin and touching my hair that was more blonde then. And they were the ones that really welcomed me in, and that I didn't feel threatened by, so I let them gather around me. And they took me over to one of the fire circles. And it was one of the girls who really told a story to welcome me in. And I couldn't understand, it was in Venda, but I could understand the sentiment and the gestures. And I could tell she was saying something like, "And she came from far to join us here." And she was storying me in. And I had never had a story told about me. I had never been welcomed in this way, and I'd never had a sense of I was important to them and to the belonging that was there. So they started covering me with ash. She put ash from the fire on my skin, and the other children joined in, and they're putting ash in my hair and ash on my clothes, and they were making me look more like them. And again, it was the first sense of belonging I'd ever had in my 8 years.
That was just the beginning to Robin's story. You can listen to our entire interview at AppalachianVibes.net Archives, Season 3, Episode 3. You can learn more about Robin Landsong at robinlandsong.com. Appalachian Vibes is brought to you by Galax Tourism, made possible by Virginia is for Lovers. Visit Galax, building our future while celebrating our past. You can learn more about Galax at visitgalax.com. I'm Amanda Bakke. You can drop me a line at appalachianvibes@gmail.com. And I'll see y'all next Saturday at 6 a.m. for the full episode of Appalachian Vibes from WNCW.